Greetings, friends. I'm John Haspel. This is a recording of our Saturday morning Dhamma class at Cross River Meditation Center in Frenchtown, New Jersey, from June 17, 2017. This Saturday's talk and Sangha discussion is the first of seven talks on the Satipatthana Sutta, the Sutta on the Four Foundations of Mindfulness. If you find benefit from this talk, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. Thank you. Peace. So again, welcome everyone. Welcome, Mary. I'm glad you made it. And in the back row is Michael. Welcome, Michael. It's good to see you here. Michael owns this building and maintains these buildings so wonderfully well. Thank you for all that. Matt gave Mike a call, I think yesterday morning. And said the air conditioner's not working. And about 6 seconds later, he was here fixing it. So thank you for that.
Thank you for the flowers.
Oh, it was
out the front door.
Oh, you're welcome.
That's what I mean. You maintain this building and everything so wonderfully well. Thank you for all that.
Oh, thank you.
The Four Foundations of Mindfulness. Let me just read from the article and I'll comment on it. If you have any questions, just holler out or put your hand up. This sutta is something that has been cited since the time the Buddha gave it. It's one of the most cited suttas today, even in those traditions that have adapted it in different ways. And it really is a primary teaching of the Buddha. Of course, mindfulness would be. But you'll notice in the sutta, the Buddha teaches how to apply mindfulness in very specific ways. Mindfulness means to recollect or to hold in mind, and we can obviously do that with anything. An ongoing aspect of a conditioned mind rooted in ignorance is holding in mind, being mindful of qualities that only continue ignorance. So the Buddha taught mindfulness in a way to recognize the things that we're holding in mind that are unskillful and to start inclining our minds towards more skillful ways of thinking, of ongoing thinking. In the Satipatthana Sutta, the Buddha teaches the four foundations of mindfulness as the framework for meditation, for what occurs in meditation, and as a reference for mindfulness in all areas of a Dhamma practitioner's moment-by-moment life. And that last just refers to hold in mind the principles of the Eightfold Path as the framework for our life. Much is made of the detailed account of the different breaths and bodily functions that are taught, the Buddha discusses in the sutta, to imply that the Buddha is teaching to manufacture the experience of these differences. In other words, You'll see when I read the sutta itself, the Buddha talks about the in-breath and the out-breath and whether a breath is long or short or shallow or deep. And in much of the later commentaries, that's taken as direction. In other words, you should have meditation practices that are focused on developing a long in-breath and a long out-breath and a short in-breath and a short out-breath and a shallow in-breath. You can see how that's just distraction, wouldn't it? I mean, if you're thinking about having to manipulate your breath in any way, there's no usefulness as far as developing concentration. The Buddha is just pointing out to be mindful of your breath and however it's appearing during any particular meditation session, to just notice it and come back to the sensation of breathing without the need to alter it in any day, in any way. Even during the Buddha's time, there was a lot of practices that utilized breath manipulation as part of their practice. In fact, one of the practices that the Buddha was involved with prior to his awakening was a very severe manipulation of the breath practice. And it was told that he had developed this practice to such an extent that when the Buddha was engaged in this practice, you couldn't tell whether he was alive or dead. Because there was such a long period of time between one breath and the next breath, and they were so shallow. The Buddha realized upon his awakening that there was no value in that. It was just another ascetic practice of self-denial. And again, that's what the Buddha is referring to in this. Just breathe and just be mindful of your breath. And then there's, I might not get to it today, but there's an aspect of this where the Buddha's talking to be mindful of just the human body and how the human body will die and it will decompose. And he gets into a rather lengthy description of what happens when a human body decomposes. And many people have taken that to develop a meditation practice about just that. It's called meditation on the charnel grounds. And it's just a huge distraction. And again, the Buddha is not trying to teach us how awful it is to have a human body, but just to recognize that it is prone to death and it's prone to decomposition, what happens when a body dies, so that we don't become so enamored with being attached to a body. Stop creating an identity. It's just a practical teaching on why would you want to hold on to this thing that is prone this way, rather than create a meditation practice about the decomposition of the body. So all of that contradicts the fundamental teaching to not establish a self in any event or isolated experience. And if you could think about engaging in a long meditation practice and looking at the details of everything that happens as a body decomposes, and he gets into bodily fluids and pus and things eating your body, all you're doing is creating a... Yeah, it's rather unpleasant. And I did it for a while because I thought it was important until I realized it was ridiculous. And the reason why it was ridiculous, the reason why is because all we're doing is strengthening a self-referential identity with that which we're supposed to be letting go of. Look at how awful this is. Look what happens to me. Well, it's not. It should be looked at as a dispassionate, impersonal experience. This is not me. This is not mine, as the Buddha often teaches. So recognize that what we so want to cling to is something that, realistically, why would you want to cling to something that's prone to that kind of suffering? What is described here is a dispassionate mindfulness of what has occurred, again, in all areas of our life, the Satipatthana Sutta. On one occasion, the Buddha was in Kamasadama, where he addressed those assembled. Friends, there are four frames of reference, four foundations of mindfulness, that are required for the purification of all beings, for the overcoming of sorrow and regret, for the disappearance of pain and distress, for establishing the right method of practice, and for complete unbinding. Mindfulness in this way is pretty important, isn't it? The Buddha asked the rhetorical question, so what are these four? Number one, being mindful of the breath and the body, determined and alert, and abandoning craving and aversion to what is occurring. That's exactly what we do when we begin our meditation practice, isn't it? The first thing we do is become mindful of the breath in the body, and we use that to cease any distracting thoughts, anything that we're caught up in, that would further that distraction, that would further eye-making within our meditation practice. Simply become mindful of the breath in the body and recognize, when we're recognizing that we're caught up in our thoughts, and that's really as far as we need to go, we're interrupting the ongoing process of clinging one thought to the next thought to the next thought, which is in a general application or a general expression of ongoing clinging. As we develop the ability, to deepen our concentration, we're interrupting that ongoing consciousness, that thought pattern that is clinging one thought to the next, that is continuing to establish a self-referential ego self. Is that clear? Because that really is really the whole point of meditation in a very specific but important application. We use meditation to deepen concentration, and in that developing concentration, we cease creating the conditions for self-establishment rooted in ignorant views. We're simply interrupting the process, and it's a very specific but very powerful way of doing it, very effective way. Being the second foundation is being mindful of feelings arising from the sixth sense base, determined and alert, abandoning craving and aversion to what is occurring. The sixth sense base is our five physical senses interpreted by that sixth sense of ongoing consciousness, thinking rooted in ignorance. And you know, I won't get into the five clinging aggregates, but we've talked about this especially on Tuesday night, the last 3 or 4 weeks, about practicing restraint, and it is at that point of contact with our senses that we need to be most mindful of in practicing restraint, because it's at that contact that we start creating self-referential views, that we're joining with the outside world. This is me, this is mine, I like this experience, I don't like this experience. That's all part of craving and clinging and joining with the outside world. If we can recognize that and practice restraint there at the sixth sense base, we're disconnecting, again, that ongoing process. So in meditation, as feelings arise, where normally, without a well-concentrated mind and without the framework to recognize that feelings aren't something that we should be so enamored with, to simply recognize that we're reacting in some way to a feeling. And in this sense, a feeling is not just a physical feeling or a mental feeling, but it's any disturbance in the mind. And if you think about that in the context of trying to create concentration, any disturbance is antithetical, is contrary to creating a well-concentrated mind. So noticing that feelings are arising in meditation and simply recognize that that's what's occurred, come back to the sensation of breathing. We don't get into analyzing the feelings or justifying the feelings or trying to blame the world or someone else for the feeling. Simply recognize that a feeling has arisen, come back to the sensation of breathing. And that's what we do in meditation, but it's really what we should do off our cushion too. There's no reason to get into justification or analysis of any feeling. And that leads to the next foundation of mindfulness. Be mindful of thoughts arising from the sixth sense base, determined and alert, abandoning craving and aversion to what is occurring. The same explanation. Now, just because the Buddha mentions feelings first and then thoughts following feelings doesn't mean that that progression is always the same. It's often, at least the way we recognize it, it's often that a thought will bring a feeling to mind. The thought initiates the feeling. Sometimes it's a feeling that initiates a series of ongoing thinking. You know, so this isn't linear. The next foundation of mindfulness is being mindful of the present quality of mind, determined and alert, and abandoning craving and aversion to what is occurring. So in our meditation practice, we first become mindful of the sensation of breathing. And as our minds quiet down, even just a little bit, we start noticing that feelings and thoughts are taking our attention, are becoming a distraction. We simply recognize that, come back to the sensation of breathing. And then in a general way, we also notice that how reacting or not reacting to feelings and thoughts affects the present quality of our mind. That's the fourth foundation of mindfulness. Notice how our concentration and refined mindfulness, if it is, contributes to a calm and peaceful mind. And if it is unrefined, if it's continually reactive, and if we're using our thoughts to continue self-referential views, we're going to be contributing to a less than peaceful mind state, a distracted mind state. That's the present quality of mind. That's what we're, and again, only to notice it, not to analyze it, not to judge it, but understand where it comes from. So if we find that we have, at any point, an agitated, disturbed, or very distracted quality of mind, simply recognize that it's because of reaction to what's occurring in our life that has resulted in this present quality of mind, and that we have control about that. Remember in the Vitakasanthana Sutta, the Buddha teaches at the end of that sutta that finally we gain the ability to think what we want to think when we want to think it. Isn't that remarkable? And that's the point of this noticing the quality of our mind. If it's less than peaceful, just recognize you have a little bit more Dhamma practice to do. And that practice is very specific. Again, that's what the framework of the Eightfold Path is for. Is that clear where I've gone so far this morning? Okay. Like I said, this is a rather long, involved sutta, and so I'm breaking it up into four talks. I haven't quite figured out where I'm going to take the first break, but I think time will tell. My comment here, the sixth sense base is the five physical senses and conscious thought. It is through the sixth sense base that self-referential contact and self-identification or attachment with phenomena is established. We join with the world. Feelings in this reference is any disturbance in the mind and conscious thought, and is ongoing thinking that is rooted in ignorance prior to awakening. So again, just to make that point that I make often, when I'm talking about consciousness in this new agey kind of way of looking at these things, not that we do, but consciousness is often seen as this grand cosmic thing with a giant sea that we should all aspire to and that we're all a part of. In the reference here, consciousness is just ongoing thinking rooted in ignorance. It's nothing to aspire to. It's to recognize and abandon. The breath in the body, the Buddha's words. And how does one remain mindful of the breath in the body in and of itself? Meaning, this is all we're doing. Don't introduce anything else into this process. In and of itself. Finding a secluded spot, the shade of a tree or an empty hut. This is the only instruction that the Buddha taught about the environment that we should meditate in. Finding a secluded spot, the shade of a tree or an empty hut, sitting erect with legs crossed in front, unless we don't want to, sitting in a chair is fine. And placing attention on the breath. In its most basic, that's the Buddha's entire teaching on meditation. And the rest of this is what to do with what develops during meditation. Place attention on the breath. Remaining mindful of the breath, he reiterates the importance of that. Breathe in and breathe out. Breathe in and breathe out. This is one of those things that when I started looking at what I was being taught many years ago, why was there such an emphasis placed on simply breathing in and breathing out? And it wasn't until I read the Buddhist teachings on this that I realized all he's saying is just be mindful of your breath. Breathe in and breathe out. Mindful of the breath, long or short, breathe in and breathe out. Training yourself to be sensitive to the breath and calming any bodily function. Again, just be mindful of the breath and let your body relax. Ever mindful, calming the body with each in-breath and with each out-breath. Just, again, be mindful that as you're maintaining your concentration on your breath, your mindfulness of your breath, just be mindful that your body's relaxing. And it will. If you're mindful of your breath, your body will naturally relax. The relaxed state is the natural state of a human body. It wants to be relaxed. It's only by distracted and agitated thoughts that we keep the stress level arise. Remember the first noble truth, there is dukkha. Another word for that is there is stress. And how do we create that stress? The second noble truth, by craving for and clinging to those things that have distracted us. When we are mindful of our breath, and only our breath, our body begins to relax because we're separating from being joining to those things that have arisen from craving and clinging. Is that clear? It's very important. That's why meditation in the context that the Buddha taught it and the method that he taught, the technique that he taught is so important, because it directly addresses the problem of our contribution to our own stress. Be mindful of the sensation of breathing in our bodies. Go back one sentence. Ever mindful, calming the body with each in-breath and each out-breath. Remaining mindful of the breath in the body, mindful of the in-breath and the out-breath, the arising and passing away of phenomena with regard to the body. How does that relate, being mindful of the arising and passing away? Look at your breath. It arises and it passes away. It arises and it passes away. That's your connection to your life, to the arising and passing away of your life. And in that instant, your life arises and it passes away. And it arises again and it passes away. And if we can remain that dispassionately mindful to what's occurring in our life, we'll never create another stressful thought. This is how life unfolds. It arises and it passes away. Even the things that grab our attention in a very strong way will arise and they will pass away. Everything in the phenomenal world is impermanence. This goes right back to the teachings on the three marks of existence, and it goes directly back to the teachings on the four noble truths. Remember when Kandana heard these teachings? He declared, all conditioned things that arise are subject to cessation. All conditioned things that arise will pass away. Noticing the arising and the passing away of our breath is a very profound teaching on the arising and passing away of all phenomena. When we get distracted or try to incorporate other practices into our meditation practice, such as how long is this breath, or let me make this a long breath, or any of the other things, we're missing that subtle and most important point, the arising and passing away of all phenomena. Excuse me. Once we can truly recognize that at its most profound level, the arising and passing away of all things, we will let go of everything. We'll cease creating any self-identifiable, self-referential views attached to anything. Lao Tzu, the great Chinese sage, said that once we recognize the impermanence of all things, we'll let go of everything. That's precisely what this teaching is about. And in our meditation practice, if it's practiced correctly, we can experience that recognition of arising and passing away with each breath. And in that way, we're developing profound concentration that supports the rest of the mindfulness necessary to develop the entire Eightfold Path. I'm going to have to go back just to keep this in context. Remaining mindful of the breath in the body, mindful of the in-breath and the out-breath, the arising and passing away of phenomena with regard to the body, with no self-reference. In other words, simply noticing the arising and the passing away of the breath. This is not me breathing now. And again, if you're using, overemphasizing the breath, you can't help but connect with that. Just simply notice the impersonal and dispassionate arising of the passing of the arising and passing away of your breath. There's no you there. With no self-reference, calmly noticing, there is a body. Not my body, there is a body. And then your body simply becomes a frame of reference for what's occurring. Remember when we get into the five clinging aggregates and dependent origination, I often conclude with that. When we let go of self-referential views, and everybody wants to know, what happens when I do that? Well, then your ongoing life is simply a reference to what's occurring in your life without taking anything personally. And so then the body, not my body, the body is just a reference point to what's occurring, a dispassionate, impersonal reference point. And in that way, you are much more mindfully aware and much more mindfully effective in your life. Of course, it's not your life anymore, is it? It's just the arising and passing away phenomenon. Calmly noticing there is a body, remaining independent of and not clinging to anything in the world. And guess what? The world's still going to be here whether we cling to it or not, won't it? It doesn't need our clinging to maintain itself. Just like our things don't need our clinging to continue to be ours, however we want to identify that. I used to teach this a little bit more often, but the best description I can give is you all left your homes or whatever situation you live in, and you got all your stuff there. You didn't have to bring all your stuff here to maintain possession of it, did you? It's still there. You don't have to cling to it even in a physical way for it still to be your stuff. Well, we tend to do that with our identities. We think we have to maintain a clinging attachment to our identities or we're going to lose them. We don't. What happens when you let go of all attachments to your identities? Then you're just present with life as life occurs. You're free of the stress that's caused by carrying around all those identities. My comments here. The first foundation of mindfulness, being mindful of the breath in the body, is the same mindfulness practice in our meditation practice. In meditation, we begin to quiet our minds by putting aside thoughts as thoughts arise and becoming mindful of our breathing, preferably sensation of breathing through our nose, and if that's not possible, however we find our breath. I'm going to skip a little bit of my commentary because I just basically gave it. Being mindful of what is occurring in relation to the Eightfold Path through holding in mind your breath in the body is the foundation of developing understanding of your ego personality and its relation to this distraction or stress. It's a little bit out of context, but I'm just pointing to what we're going to get to probably in 2 or 3 weeks of how the Buddha teaches the four foundations of mindfulness in relation to the Four Noble Truths, including the Eightfold Path. But just now to remind you that it's the concentration that we develop in meditation that allows us to hold in mind each factor of the Eightfold Path. That's primarily the reason why we're using meditation to deepen concentration to that end. Being mindful of your breath in your body interrupts outer focused clinging conditioned thinking and begins to quiet your mind with directed inner mindfulness. Being mindful of the in-breath and the out-breath brings mindfulness to the arising and passing away of all phenomena. What is being described here is a simple and direct mindfulness of the breath, which then follows a dispassionate mindfulness of feelings arising and passing away, and thoughts arising and passing away. Finally, one becomes mindful of the arising and passing away of the quality of mind, and that leads to that fourth foundation of mindfulness. When we start noticing the quality of our mind, we'll start noticing that it is temporary too. And why is that important? Because when we find ourselves in an agitated or distracted quality of mind, we won't overreact to it. We'll recognize that no matter what, and the direct way is to become mindful of the sensation of breathing, but no matter what we do, this present quality of mind is impermanent, and it will pass. And it will pass much quicker when we stop insisting that it pass right now. You hear me say often, to be at peace with a less than peaceful mind state. That's all that means. To be at peace with what's occurring in your mind right now, knowing that in the next moment, it's like foam on the water, as the Buddha says. It just vanishes. There's nothing that you have to do. And if you insist that there's something you have to do to change the quality of your mind, you are now joined with that quality of mind. You just exacerbate it. That's the essence of craving and clinging. I want this to change right now. I want my mind state to change in this instant. And if it doesn't, I'm going to continue to be miserable. Well, there you go. You're going to continue to be miserable. That's the essence of a conditioned mind. It's the essence of putting condition on your own quality of mind. The Buddha continues. This is taking our meditation off our cushion now. When walking, be mindful of walking. When standing, be mindful of standing. When sitting, be mindful of sitting. When lying down, be mindful of lying down. In any function, be mindful that there is a body. So again, the Buddha is showing to just use the experience of what's occurring as a reference point to what's occurring. This is another situation where many modern teachers have made meditation out of exaggerated walking or anything else. The Buddha is just pointing out to when you're walking, be mindful that you're walking. Don't be thinking about other things. Don't be distracted by other things. And be mindful that there's a body walking, period. And that opens you up to what's really occurring around you. And we've all experienced this, whether we've done it directly or not, walking along the towpath and noticing the beauty of the day and the birds and the water and anything else. In that moment, you've let go of self-referential views, unless you're attached to those things, and you're simply present with life as life occurs. We've all had those moments. I can't think of the gentleman's name. Maxwell Maltz used to call these peak experiences. And they are, but they're peak not because of what's occurring outside. It's because we're entirely mindful of what's occurring. That's a peak experience. Maxwell Maltz wrote these series of books on self-actualizations, which are good. I mean, I read them all. I'm not going to say he missed the point as far as the Buddhist teaching is concerned. The most self-actualized we can ever be is to be mindful of what's occurring in this moment. That's self-actualization without promoting an ego-based self. It's simply being a reference point to what's occurring. The Buddha continues, when going about, looking this way and that, when bending or reaching, when carrying a bowl or a cloak, when eating, drinking, or savoring food, when eliminating waste, when walking, standing, sitting, sleeping, walking, talking, or silent, be fully mindful. Just be mindful of what you're doing. Why did it take an awakened human being to even point this out? Why don't we just do this naturally? Because we're so distracted by our own self-referential views. We're so caught up in what we need to be happy and what we need next to be happy, and what we need to avoid and what we need next to avoid, that we miss the whole point that we're taking a nice walk on a towpath, or we're sitting in a meditation class, or we're driving a car, or we're talking to our kids or our spouse or walking our dog. We miss our life. And that's the real underlying stress, to not be present with life as life occurs. That's the great stress. It's interesting that it took almost 2,600 years for the medical profession to recognize the incredible debilitating effects of stress. The Buddha figured it out as the primary problem 2,600 years ago. It's great that we've recognized this now. And the practices that have grown up around that recognition of stress, such as mindfulness-based stress reduction, those are wonderful practices. They're not the same mindfulness that the Buddha taught, though. Again, bringing it back into this context. The Buddha continues. Let me read the last line again, just to keep this in context. Independent of and not clinging to anything in the world. Just as a person with good eyesight, emptying a bag full of mixed grains, would know, this is wheat, this is rice, these are beans, these are sesame seeds. In the same way, one remains mindful from the soles of their feet to the top of their head, encased in skin. There is hair, nails, teeth, tendons, bones, marrow, organs, feces, phlegm, blood, urine, sweat, fat, tears, saliva, mucus, and fluid in the joints. Why is he pointing? Again, people make long meditations about that. Just to be mindful. This is what makes you up. There's a process that's ongoing that needs to continue in order for you to maintain your mindfulness. And that is just to teach to the necessity of taking good care of this thing, but not become overly enamored. Notice the process that you are involved in. Don't take it for granted and don't become so enamored with it. Be mindful of what's occurring. In this way, one is mindful of the four elements, the earth element, the water element, the fire element, and the wind element. Why is that important? Why is the Buddha referencing it here? Because if you look at those elements clearly, you recognize they're all impermanent. And it's in their coming together in the way that we do it. And I won't. This is a little touching a little bit on quantum mechanics that I won't get into, but they're in the talks on the last retreat. Quantum mechanics, the people who study quantum mechanics are just now realizing, well, I shouldn't say now, probably maybe 8 years ago they started coming to this realization, that the observer is affecting what's being observed, and they cannot separate that from the equation. That's really the problem that they're looking at now. How can I separate the observer from what's being observed, the phenomenon? I don't think they're going to be able to come to a conclusion on that. I don't think it's possible. The Buddha recognized that also 2,600 years ago. What we think in a completely universal way affects our experience, including the experience of having a body. And again, I'm not going to get into too deeply into that, but just to point out that how we think affects our moment-by-moment life. That's why mindfulness in the proper context is so important. What we hold in mind will determine our experience and nothing else. Furthermore, be mindful of the impermanence of the body to develop dispassion. We talked about that. If left unattended, this is where the meditation on eternal grounds comes from. If left unattended, a corpse decays quickly. It becomes bloated and infested. It is picked at by birds and dogs and other creatures. Eventually, nothing is left but dust. Be mindful that this very body, too, will die and pass away. This is the nature of the world and unavoidable fate. Why is that so important? When the Buddha first described suffering, he said birth is suffering, aging is suffering, sickness is suffering, death is suffering. Why did it take an awakened person to make a point of that, of something we all know? Because we want to ignore it. We don't want to recognize it. We want to think that we live forever. I know I don't think that way so much now, but when I was 25, I did think I was going to live forever, and I thought I could do things irrespective of that idea that I was going to die. We all tend to think that, and even as we start aging or we confront others that are aging, we want to ignore the fact that we're all going to die someday. In the context of the Dhamma, the reason why that's so important is because then maybe we'll do what the Buddha said we should take to the Dhamma like our hair is on fire. We're not going to live together. We'll live forever. At some point, we're going to lose the ability to awaken. And that also points to the incredible potential that the Dhamma has to awaken in this present lifetime. So many of the teachings are taught that it will take endless lifetimes to awaken, which also infers that, well, we have endless lifetimes to awaken. The Buddha never taught that. And even if that's so, and in some ways it likely is, why not awaken in this lifetime? Why not awaken right now? Why not live an awakened life for however many minutes, weeks, months, years we have left? Let's do it today. And we can. And I think we're going to. I don't mean to be flippant about that. That was a point of the Buddha's teaching. It doesn't take lifetimes. It's a teaching for human beings to awaken in this present lifetime. Only thing that's required is to take to the Dhamma and develop it wholeheartedly. That's why he taught an Eightfold Path. Let me just go a little bit further. In this way, one remains mindful of the breath in the body, the in-breath and the out-breath, the arising and the passing away of the body, independent of and not clinging to anything in the world. This is how one remains mindful of the breath in the body. I think that's a good place to stop today's talk, and then we'll pick it up next week on mindfulness of the feelings. So thank you for listening to that talk. Before we go around the room, is there any questions specifically on mindfulness of the breath in the body in the context that I put this in today? Okay, good. Mary, it's good to see you. I'm glad you made it.
Yeah, thank you for allowing me to come late.
Oh, anytime.
My practice is going well, and as with many sutta, this one's very timely, so that's all I have to say.
I'm so glad you made it. Jay, good to see you this morning. How are you?
Thanks. Good to see you. Okay. Struggling with some problems with depression, and cope with that. I don't really have much to say.
I'm glad you're here today. Mm-hmm. Lisa, good to see you.
Good to see you too, John. I'm glad you could come. This was a great subject.
I agree.
because it's just really getting down the basics, and it kind of represents the whole Buddhist teachings.
Yep.
Just concentrated, you know, just in these sort of simple ideas.
Yeah.
Why are they so hard? Because, well, just my mind tends to complicate things. I think people tend to complicate things.
Yep.
I don't know why. It's like simple isn't good enough. And also the other idea of, like, I'll be happy when.
Yeah. And we spend our whole lives waiting for when.
And not living.
Yeah.
Well, what is it that, you know, people say, you know, plan, but, and I'm going to do this then, but what about thinking about what's going on right now?
Yeah.
And it's important to me because of, you know, physical, mental, all kinds of issues. To simplify.
Yeah.
And this teaching is great.
Thank you. As a direct result of developing the Eightfold Path, we tend to start living very simplified lives. It's just a natural consequence of not being attached to a lot of things. You ask, why do we do that? It's because of conditioned thinking. The Buddha recognized the problem of always looking towards the next moment for our happiness. I'm changing the teachings in a slight way, as conditioned thinking, rooted in ignorance of the way things are, rooted in impermanence, rooted in understanding of dukkha, of suffering, and our contributions to it. That's why he taught an Eightfold Path. You're not alone. That's the common human problem, and we all do that. Even when I grew up upper middle class home, had loving parents and somewhat loving brothers and sisters. I had everything that any kid could want, really did. You know, we weren't fabulously wealthy, but there was always food on the table, clothes, you know, toys and stuff. And I was always dissatisfied. I remember even being 5 and 6 years old, just thinking, yeah, as I started getting a little older, my teen years, I started acting out because of that dissatisfaction. I never could put my finger on, you know, nothing would make me happy. And even, and that led to, you know, I think I've talked about it enough, a lot of years of drugs and alcohol, thinking that I was going to find it in the bottom of a bottle. It never happened. At 26, I addressed that problem, and then I started looking at different ways of addressing that general dissatisfaction with life, spiritual search, if you want to call it that. And even when I came across the Buddhist teaching, I was looking Buddhism, because it wasn't the Buddhist teachings at that point. I was hoping that I would find that next thing there, something to satisfy what I was craving for. And it wasn't until I actually came across the Buddhist teachings that I realized there's nothing outside of myself that can ever satisfy an insatiable ego personality. But we become so distracted by it. This is to answer your question. Why is it so hard to see? It's because the self-referential ego self insists on distraction as a way of maintaining itself. The Buddha could have nearly as accurately said as the First Noble Truth, as there is distraction, as saying there is dukkha. Because it's the preoccupation with dukkha that we are distracted from living our life. And that really is the problem. The teachings themselves are incredibly simple, and this is a good example of it. This is really the foundation of profound mindfulness that's developed through the Dhamma. And it is a simple and direct practice. But we have to keep coming at it and applying it in the correct way through the framework of the Eightfold Path to overcome conditioned mind's way of wanting to hold on to ignorance. So thank you for your insight and for what you said. Good to see you. Do you have anything to say after all that?
Just the idea of, like, we jump off our lives with stuff, other stuff, more stuff, that we junk up our minds.
Yeah.
All this junk.
Yeah. Yeah, well, and all the stuff that we have around us is also in our minds. It can't not be, you know. And that is that constant distraction, that constant clinging to things, is the perfect way to continue ignorance. Some people might not get the reference. The Buddha awakened to dependent origination, which states, from ignorance of Four Noble Truths, all manner of suffering arises. So that's my reference to ignorance. Okay, just to be clear. Tommy, good to see you this morning. How you doing?
Good morning, everyone. Well, thanks. First of all, I just was thinking I wanted to thank you for all the good work you do and how important it is.
Thank you.
You know, in my mind, which is like a tornado, and that's pretty unmiling, to be able to look forward when I'm here to be able to sit. And that's a really great blessing, because it's not something that is commonplace in my life. Though I try to, I think I have achieved a relative sense of calm in some areas. It's not my nature. My nature
is
whoa. That's my nature. Whoa. And so I enjoy the reading very much, because it did sort of simplify it, bring it down to basics, help me to better understand a whole lot. It's so funny, because I'd say there's a whole lot I don't understand, but when you listen to the simplicity and the basics, it's very straightforward.
Yeah.
But now I've just sort of got to try osmosis to bring it in and to, you know, start practicing that.
Yeah. Thank you for your kind words. You're absolutely right. We are so fortunate what's developed here. This is somewhat unique. I'm talking about a well-focused sangha that are actually developing this. And that really is all it takes, is continued practice. It's the only thing that will work. But it really isn't all that difficult. It does take determined effort. That's the sixth factor of the Eightfold Path, right? Effort. And there's no time frame on it, but the sooner the better, right?
Mm-hmm.
I'm so glad you're here today. Eva, good morning. Good to see you.
Good to be here. I found everything that you read and expressed to be very liberating.
Good.
And I couldn't explain it, but it really is simple and it is liberating. To me, life is like a merry-go-round. Music, and it's all the different horses, and you want to be on that one, but you got this one, but you want to push that one off because that's the horse you really wanted, and then you get off on the side, but you can't really let it go because it's still whirling around, and people are calling you to come into it, and you just kind of want to say, stop, leave it alone. And I too have found like calm away from the merry-go-round and not feel like I really can't live life unless I'm there with it. And sometimes it's kind of painful because there are people there that I want to hold on to, and I can't bring them there and I can't reach over, whatever. So it's just liberating to know that I have the path and I can walk it, and you usually have to walk it alone. Anyway.
Thank you. That last that you talked about, the Buddha, when the Buddha described himself, he used the word Tathagata, which means one who has left the world behind and has established themselves fully in reality. That one word does mean all that. And so that leaving the world behind is at times painful in itself, you know, because you realize that you can't continue those attachments in the way that you used to, but you can also be much more mindfully present to what's occurring. And that's even a much more effective way of living our lives, even with those people that we used to be joined at the hip with, and now we're just joined. It's just part of our
really
lives.
To leave, you can sort of find a place to be in the middle of it all and not.
Yeah.
That would be the ultimate, right?
Yeah. It's interesting the metaphors that we used this morning and in general to describe the quality of our mind: tornado and a merry-go-round, monkey mind. You know, that's the common human problem. We all describe ourselves, at least before we come to this practice, as being stuck in a mind that we can't. I think nearly every student I've ever had, one of the first things they do is describe themselves as having a mind that they can't calm down in one way or the other. It's a common human problem. It really isn't. It's an awful way to live our lives, to have a mind that we've literally lost control of. But the entire Dhamma is about gaining control of our minds, becoming well concentrated, and understanding right view, the way to look at reality, gaining the ability to think what we want to think when we want to think it, not being driven by conditioned thinking. Thank you. Good to see you this morning. Kevin, good morning. How are you?
And this is such an important teaching, and it really is so essential. It's a piece of the Eightfold Path, but it is the Eightfold Path.
Yeah.
It's the entire Dhamma, sort of, I don't know, kind of like a lotus blossom. It just keeps unfolding. That makes it so simple, what people have said, to follow it, to understand it. I think we just need to appreciate those few moments of deepening concentration that we get from our practice and continue so that they can expand.
Yeah.
And that we can, all of us, attain awakening.
Thank you for pointing that out. It really is important to recognize the progress, the little bits of concentration that we develop that adds up to a complete practice. You know, that's one of the reasons why the Buddha used that term, ahipasika, come and see for yourself, reminding us that we should be mindful of the progress that we're making. That's important. And it doesn't take a lot. It doesn't take lifetimes. Very quickly, if we're developing the practice the way the Buddha taught it, we'll start recognizing the benefits. And that just gives us more enthusiasm to keep going. Thank you, Kevin. Good to see you. Good morning, Diane. Good to see you.
Good morning, Tom.
How are you?
I'm well.
Good.
Thank you for continually having these classes. I just really appreciate it.
You're welcome.
I was, I don't know what, maybe, well, maybe I do. I don't know why I've been thinking this, but I remembered, cold on the intake, warm
right.
on the outtake.
Yeah.
And when we were over at Regalsville.
Really? You were coming back then?
Yeah.
Oh.
And I remember one of the first times you said that, and then we commented afterward. I thought, oh my gosh, did I cut the hair in my nose? is that showing? I kind of worried through the whole meditation of, oh my gosh, you know, I'm not so good. Most times when I do meditate, I think about that, and it kind of keeps me clipping the hair in my nose. So, one good thing about meditation.
I'm going to include that. Be mindful of the hairs in your nose. The fluttering of the hairs in your nose. Good point.
Well, but it, in a way, it's kind of... it's not bad, a bad thing, because it's, you know, I'm there with my, you know, I'm in the moment kind of thing. And I think one of the things I continually probably need to be reminded of, and that's in many ways what was happening this morning, was that ego self, you know, doesn't want me to meditate and will think of a gazillion excuses not to meditate. You're too tired, so just go take a nap. You know, you have too much to do. Yada, yada, yada. I mean, my mind is just really creative when it comes to reasons not to meditate. And it's been kind of interesting and fun almost to recognize ego's excuses and just say, hey, I gotcha, and sit. And then when I sit, the thing that's interesting too is, and I've read a lot of different types of meditation, you know, possibilities and stuff like that, and my favorite one is just sit. When you sit, just sit. And it's so simple, but it helps me to, you know, recognize ego distractions and things like that. Yesterday, I woke up, and I didn't think I felt bad, but I looked in the mirror, and I looked like S-H-I-T, and I thought, boy, I need a me day. And I used to do that with the kids when they were little. If their attitude was getting extremely obnoxious, or, you know, if they had an attitude problem, I would really often suggest, you know, I would suggest at those times that they take a me day and stay home from school and just, you know, goof off. And it kept them from getting sick and stuff like that. So I took yesterday off, a me day. And I felt so much better. And what I think, what I'm hearing about this mindfulness is to pay attention in, and I keep being appreciative for metta. I don't know, I'm all over the place, but the loving kindness. May I be filled with loving kindness. If I can't be loving and kind toward me, I can't be loving and kind toward anyone else. And taking a me day is, you know, I'm stopping and not producing anything. It's probably one of the most precious gifts I give to myself, because it says I appreciate you. I appreciate my body. I am so thankful for my body being healthy and the way it is. And I just think meditation really teaches me to love in a way that's far beyond any definition of love that I've heard. But it's, you know, full appreciation and acceptance for things, for everything as it is. And I appreciate the practice of meditation and the opportunity to learn about my mind. It's been one of the most fabulous, it's the most fabulous journey I've ever been on.
I agree.
And it's ongoing. That's the thing, that was one thing I was thinking on the way here. Our Western culture is so geared to getting a degree, getting a master's degree, getting a doctorate degree, getting, you know, the highest form of education, or getting something done, or getting, you know, achieving. And meditation, there's no achievement. And I think it's quite paradoxical.
Yeah, there's a lot of paradoxes. Thank you so much. That aversion to sitting is even addressed in the Four Foundations of Mindfulness later on, the third or fourth week. We'll get to that, where the Buddha describes the hindrances to practice. So thank you, Diane. Good to see you. Michael, welcome this morning. Good to see you.
Well, thank you. Thank you for inviting me, and thank you, everybody.
You're always welcome. You don't need an invite.
what's so striking to me is, as you know, I'm kind of a loner. I meditate by myself. But the value of everybody's sharing just reinforces the teaching, your explanation of it. And if I might share... Of course, the nasal here is a cortex, Oh, oh my God. See that competitive ego? Yeah. Okay, I'm done. So as I was waiting to yesterday to talk about the building, I got a, wasn't a call, it was a text message at 4 a.m. I knew about it because the phone was charging and it made this noise and woke me up. And I couldn't resist. I had to see what it was. And unfortunately, well, maybe fortunately, a bat flew into one of the apartments and upset the occupant, which, you talk about the monkey mind, I call it the little shitty committee in my head, went into overdrive where I could not, I couldn't stop it. And I lay there on the bed trying to fall back asleep. And by the grace of God, I thought, no, get up and breathe, meditate. Two or three breaths, I transcended, put things in perspective. I realized I wasn't my thoughts. I was just, I was the consciousness that was witnessing them, so to speak. And the peace, and then the ability to deal with it that day, because again, I was taking it personally. I should have done something different. I'm wrong, I'm bad, my self-loathing kicked in. And three breaths, maybe two, boom. I was there. And so having the, how would you say, the practical experience coupled with the intellectual understanding, I could not believe how profound and how this simple technique was. And I said, wow, this guy knows what he's talking about.
You mean so, the yeah, Buddha?
I was very grateful that I was able to get out of that, because I was going to be much use to that to anyone. Yeah,
that's right.
Yeah. So it really was profound. Yeah. So I'm grateful for the bats.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you, Mike. I'm so glad you joined us today.
Yeah. Thank you.
Good morning, Mary. Good to see you.
Good to see you. Good to be here. You know what I love about the teachings of the Buddha is he says the same things posed in different ways.
Yeah.
And drive home this point, and it's always the same point. He never gets off track, and I just love the way his teachings do that. And you hear the things coming out in different directions. To me, you can't help but incorporate them into your daily life, and I'm grateful that I've been able to do that. And you know, little by little, you know, in my mind, take a deep breath and not be reactive, and it's all the difference in the world.
Yeah. It really does. Thank you for saying that. It's remarkable when you read the suttas. The preserved teachings of the Buddha are included in a book called the Pali Canon and a subset of books called the Sutta Pitaka. Sutta means a collection. I mean, Pitaka means, Sutta means teachings, Pitaka means collection. But they're not written in chronological order. In other words, this is the Buddha's first teaching, his second, third. They're grouped in different ways, and I won't get into that. But if you read just one sutta and you take it out of context, it's very hard to understand what he's trying to teach. But when you keep it in the context of Four Noble Truths, it's very easy to see what he means by what he's teaching. And what is remarkable is it said that the Buddha gave over 84,000 discourses. 84,000 in that is metaphorical for a lot. Nobody really knows. But there's not a wasted word in any of these. You know, I know I'm probably guilty of wasting a few words here and there. Everything he taught and every word that he used was needed for the situation that was at hand and spoke directly to developing understanding. You know, and it really is remarkable. When you, it takes an awakened mind, I guess, to do that. But thank you for saying that, too. Debbie, good to see you. Good morning.
You know how you take in things at a different level, even though you've heard them before.
Yeah.
So, for me today, it was the in and out of the breath, and that when we talk about that, I think it was different for some reason for me, the in and out of the breath, as such a way to think about impermanency, you know? And just so, as the breath goes in and out, the thoughts go in and out, the feelings go in and out, you know? It was just all just lovely. This is a lovely thought and helpful. So that's all.
Thank you. It is lovely, and it's simple. It's lovely in its simplicity. Just be mindful of your breathing.
Yeah.
The in and out. And notice the correlation between the arising and the passing away of phenomena. It's tied directly to your breath. That's it. Not more than that, you know. It's not. And that's the, you know, that's the other problem with the ego. The ego hears something like that and says, well, okay, that sounds pretty good, but what else? There's got to be more to this than just. No, there isn't. Thank you. Lorna, good to see you this morning. How are you?
Well, thank you. I think one of the most powerful things I think before I meditate, to settle down to meditate, is this is the time to meditate.
Yeah.
That sentence brings it's an instruction to my mind to meditate. And I often think that before I meditate. That's the last, before I go into the meditation, this is the time to meditate. It's the last thing I think. And I think that's helpful. Generally, I enjoy meditation. I'm not sure if I enjoy meditation because it does me a lot of good or my ego band up in it, I don't know, probably a bit of both. I have been noticing that I have been watching my sense gates, probably from the teachings that you've been doing on the Tuesday night. I have been mindful of observing my sense gates and when I have sensations and the triggering from that. Not saying I've always done a lot about it, but at least I've observed and I'm a lot more aware of that skill than I used to be. So that's a good thing. And then just to kind of capitalize on what Maura said, said that, you know, it's been a wonderful teaching, and I would just like to say it's a wonderful teaching, wonderfully taught. Your skills and understanding this is when you can really put the finest point and the details to such a fine degree into the teaching, into a sutta, and you know it really holds your interest, and I appreciate it so much. I really do appreciate it. It sounds like you've done this before.
It really is an incredible privilege and honor to be able to teach these things that I think are the most important teachings that have ever been given. And if it wasn't for the Sangha, for all of you, it'd be pretty foolish sitting here every Saturday morning talking about this stuff by myself, wouldn't it? So thank you. And what you said, I used to give that instruction at the beginning of every meditation, now is the time to meditate. And I don't know why, honestly, I don't know why I stopped giving that instruction, but if this older memory serves, I'll bring it back up again. It just fell away. An act of impermanence. So a few announcements are... Sangha Picnic is July 15th, rain date the 16th, just across the bridge, about 10 minutes from here, maybe even less, at Morris House. It's a beautiful property with a really nice pool and a lot of room for dogs and cats and horses and goats and all that to run around. Mm-hmm. So bring your pets, bring your kids, bring your friends, and we're going to have a great party. There's a link in the emails to a page on the website that has directions and a little bit of information, but I hope you can join us. It's going to be a lot of fun. Our retreat's coming up, our fall retreat, October 19th to 22nd. If you're going to join us, and I hope you all do, please sign up as soon as you can. That helps my logistics greatly. So we'll finish with metta, as we always do. Find your relaxed meditative posture and gently close your eyes and gently close your mouths. And again, take a moment to become aware of the sensation of breathing in your body. and let that mindfulness of your breath cease any distracting thoughts to the past or to the future or that may have arisen from our talk today. And metta is both an aspiration for those of us developing the Eightfold Path and an ongoing expression of an awakened, fully mature human being. And these are the Buddha's words on metta from the Karaniya Metta Sutta. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied. Unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways. Peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud or demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. Wishing in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. Radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Thank you all for a wonderful class. Peace.
Thank you for listening. Please visit crossrivermeditation.com for guided meditations and instruction and Dhamma articles, recorded talks, and videos. We rely on donations to support these talks. If you find benefit from these talks, please consider a donation at crossrivermeditation.com. These talks are copyrighted and are distributed under a Creative Commons License 4.0. Please feel free to contact me through crossrivermeditation.com. Peace.